Jesse looks frozen, though.
Jesse, can you hear us?
At first, I thought he was just staring into the camera, completely unimpressed that I'm phoning this in from my private jet. But now I think his video is stuck.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
Okay, he blinked, so he's back. All right, so... Access of Easy, Salon number 28, with Jesse Hirsch from Ottawa Valley, Charles Hugh Smith from Hawaii, and I am phoning it in from my private jet, where I'm a... Well, I'm not really on a private jet. I guess I can admit that now. We won't go through the rest of the episode under the pretense. But I thought we would all have private jet backgrounds on today's episode, but I guess not. And that was an article I circulated to Jesse and Charles a couple days ago about there's a studio in Los Angeles that's renting out an interior of a private jet for Instagram influencers to rent by the hour. So they sort of pose in this studio and do their influencing. But... here we are. What do you guys want to talk about today?
Well, for me, I think the V-shaped narrative is and the fragility of that V-shaped narrative globally is interesting. That we've had a V-shaped recovery in GDP in the US and elsewhere, and everything's supposed to be back to normal and going swimmingly, but we seem to be heading for some shoals of reality, and so how we navigate those shoals is an interesting topic to my mind. But
you know, just as you were saying that, my phone gave me a Wall Street Journal breaking news alert that says Amazon posted a record $96.2 billion in sales last quarter, one of their biggest quarters ever. So,
but did they turn a profit?
It doesn't say here. I actually don't know if Amazon is profitable these days. I think they are. You know,
no, like, I mean, they've been deliberately not profitable on purpose.
Yeah.
As part of their monopoly practices, which is why I asked.
I think they
we digress.
Yes, we do. Sorry, Jesse, I probably jumped in front. They're trading at a PE of 123. But anyhow, what did you want to talk about this week?
I have no idea what you just said or what that means. And I didn't really come with anything to talk about as per usual. I just show up.
Well, maybe I'll just quickly decipher what a PE multiple means. It means that if you actually buy Amazon and they gave all of their profits back to shareholders, it would take you 123 years to get your money back on your investment into Amazon. If it was just...
So that's not good.
It's not supposed to be good, but in this day and age, in this new economy age, it doesn't matter if you have a PE of 123 or 10,000 or, you know.
Well, then why did you tell me that they did?
Why did I tell you that?
If it doesn't matter, then why did you say it?
Well, it matters to old school investors that actually look at fundamentals. It just means that, to Charles's point, we are living in an economy that is increasingly detached from reality. And the narrative of the V-shaped recovery, like I think I saw a GDP print this morning that they're kind of high-fiving everybody that the economy, the U.S. economy, put up a 33% quarter-over-quarter increase in GDP output. And I'm like, why are we high-fiving ourselves for a 33% print when we've just bombed out the entire economy and probably took it more than 33% down from the top? So it's this whole quarter-to-quarter mindset and month-to-month mindset really is part of I think, the long-term problem of why these markets are so detached from reality.
Yeah, let me speak, bring up two other quick topics. One is,
I would like you to, I do definitely want to hear you elaborate on your original topic, which I think Mark was just setting you up on.
Yeah, and I'm kind of, I think, adding to that, which is Emanuel Wallerstein. He died in 2019. He was a longtime critic of capitalism. His theoretical construct was called world systems. And he was, he said something that I'm going to paraphrase, like, capitalism is no longer appealing to capitalists. And I think that's part of the problem here, is that if you take out the six big tech monopolies or cartels, then the rest of the stock market's gone nowhere for years, right? And so we're basically standing on the steer, the stern of the Titanic. You know, there's six guys up there, the big tech monopolies, and they're holding up the entire stock market and presumably most of the economy. But in terms of, like, being appealing, is the system appealing to actually go out and start a business and hire a lot of people? No, otherwise people would be doing it, right? So there's that element of, are we at the end of the process, you know, as we've talked about, whatever you want to call it. And I think the other thing that's interesting about it is, you know, the whole element of fantasy, you know, magical thinking, or whatever you want to call it, denial, magical thinking, where the desperation to return to the good old days is so palpable that people will believe anything. And that's partly why the PE doesn't matter, you know, because it's like hopium, fantasy, magical thinking, that we're gonna be able to lift all boats once again on the backs of these six, you know, big tech monopolies.
I do feel that word magical thinking is getting quite a bit of usage these days, and not necessarily for the same reasons. Like, it's the kind of phrase that when I hear it, it captures my attention, you know, partly I think by design, because the word magical thinking is literally designed to evoke magic, but in particular because it gets into this idea that we're in a very frightening spot. We're in a resurging pandemic, where economic uncertainty certainly shrouds people's optimism for the future. There's a lack of institutional credibility. And I think that lends itself to a kind of magical thinking, that people want to believe in something. You know, we're also in a kind of slump for religions. Well, not everyone. There still are a lot of people who devoutly believe in religion. I think historically, we're in a bit of a low point in that most people don't find the same meaning from religion. And so it's almost as if magical thinking is filling that void. And that magical thinking can be very petty or modest in terms of Marx's snide reference to the influencers and their manufactured world of private jets and vacations and glamour. But I think it's also true when it comes to conspiracy theory and when it comes to this desire that there's somebody responsible when in fact there isn't. And there's a desire to imagine a conspiracy that someone is behind all this, because that is a much easier explanation than, no, there isn't anyone behind all this, and that's the problem, that there really isn't anyone in control. So I am admittedly, in a anti-book phase of my life, but since you're both bibliophiles, I did feel that I had to bring you both a recommendation I heard from a podcast this week on a book called Kleptopia. And
yes.
Kleptopia, I think we're both Hidden Forces listeners there, Mark.
Yeah.
Kleptopia struck me as a very appropriate phrase for the way in which the kleptocracies have not only evolved, but created a network of kleptocracies where they all support each other, creating this kleptopia, which I'm not sure I totally agree with. I find myself susceptible to the argument, but it struck me it still seemed a little bit like magical thinking, that it was still projecting a kind of power onto people who I think are incompetent. And I'll end by saying, to me, the last 4 years, the poster child of the kleptocracy has been Jared Kushner, right? When I think of someone who is sort of most brazenly looting in the open and using the mechanisms of state to benefit not just his own personal interest, but to literally steal, he doesn't strike me as competent. Yes, a kleptocrat. Yes, you know, someone who is blatantly enriching himself and his friends, but almost by accident, and not with a level of competence, and not to the extent that I think he's going to get away with it, hence why we're having this conversation about him. But I don't know. I just put that out there, that it as much as I loved the conversation on Hidden Forces, it did make me think that maybe we're overreacting, and maybe the kleptocracy, while very real, is a product itself of its own kind of magical thinking, both on behalf of the kleptocrats who think they can get away with it, and I don't think they will, and the rest of us thinking that the kleptocracy is larger or more grandiose than it is, when in fact it's just a bunch of idiots stealing. We can all see them, and I don't understand why we don't stop them.
Well, allow me to just jump in here for a second. Charles pointed out, and he's not the only one to point out, that in fact, I was just listening to Jim Rickards on Trigonometry yesterday, and he said, you might as well not call it the S&P 500 anymore. You might as well call it the S&P 6, because it is six stocks that is driving all the gains in the stock market right now. Now, rewind back a few months to when the Fed introduced their emergency bond buying program to so-called shore up employment. Who is on the list of companies whose bonds are being bought by the Fed to shore up the economy? It's the same six top companies are all in there. Amazon had to hire, so far by my count, about 250,000 extra workers to keep up with demand. We just got the alert in on here. They had a record-setting quarter, and the Fed is printing money out of thin air to buy their bonds. And then all the other small businesses, they get loans, and if the loans are over $100,000, they're full recourse and they have to pledge their homes. So that, to me, just smells like an institutional kleptocracy. It's like, if you're $100 billion and up, the Fed will print money and buy your bonds. If you're a small businessman trying to get by through this ridiculous clusterfuck of a self-inflicted depression, you've got to pledge your house and your soul just to get, you know, an FBA loan to keep your business going. So I wrote an article about that, and that actually was one of the more viral things I've ever written about it.
Can I quickly just jump in and say I agree with you entirely, but my argument is a skilled kleptocracy, we wouldn't know it was happening, right? Like a kleptocracy that gets away with it is one that is not so brazen, so careless, so blatant as the current one. Because not to get into it, and I'll shut up and allow you to continue, but every week we've been talking about the precarity of the current regime and how its days are numbered. A true kleptocracy, you wouldn't think that. A true kleptocracy, you know, whether it's a Potemkin village or not, it achieves the illusion of stability, and we don't have that. And the extent to which this is happening so openly as to alienate people from the Fed, from the financial system, from the monetary system. And, you know, Bitcoin is reaching new highs, and alternative systems are becoming more viable. So I'm not disagreeing with your analysis. I'm just saying an incompetent kleptocracy is one that doesn't get away with it because everyone sees it, and its credibility and authority falls as a result.
But isn't one of, Charles will let you in a second, isn't the recurring underlying theme of what we talk about here, how the whole system is fraying at the edges and the center is not holding? So that maybe what used to be a competent kleptocracy is kind of hitting the limits of theft have kind of been hit in the last few crises. And and the system does try to cover it up. I mean, at the risk of like hopelessly polarizing this, which is not my point, because I'm talking about the media reaction and not the substance underneath. The Hunter Biden story, he's just as much of a kleptocrat as Jared Kushner. Had it been the other way around, it would have been nonstop CNN panels from now till Tuesday, but it wasn't. And it was such an institutional response by the media and the big tech platforms to try and keep a lid on it. Hang on. And my point was, they couldn't do it. The pot boiled over and out it came. And that's kind of like a sign of the times.
So you had some valid points in what was otherwise a turd sandwich. So I will try to address those valid points. I agree that Hunter Biden is a kleptocrat. And I think if and when Joe Biden becomes president, we'll have the opportunity to compare him to Jared in terms of him having those 4 years of access. And I think that's an interesting hypothesis to test. I would still suggest that Kushner will be bigger, but I could be wrong, because I agree that Hunter is a small cake kleptocrat to begin with. And given the opportunity of the White House, you never know. So I'm totally willing to see that. And I also grant you that the attempts to quiet or quash or marginalize that New York Post story totally backfired. And it ended up being a total disaster, not just for Twitter, but the attempt to try to spin that story. But everything else, I think, is nonsense, right? In that I don't feel that there was much story to it, especially if you look at Kushner and what he's done. But we digress. Your point, which I will grant you, is that the kleptocracy is not specific to one party, but it is a culture that pervades the corridors of power, that if you're in the corridors of power, you're naturally asking yourself, what can I take? You know, what's not chained down, and what can I, and especially, to throw it to you, Charles, the nature of financialization that allows that looting to happen at an abstract level that perhaps makes it harder for the average person to identify that the looting is taking place.
Sorry, I'm going to let you in very soon, Charles. I'm just saying, I think the theme, though, that we danced around, though, is that I think is in its last act, that entire institutional rot that we're talking about. And I think that's why we see rioting in the streets, just absolute rage.
I think you could be right, but I'm not so sure. Charles.
Are you on mute? You're on mute.
Yeah. Sorry about that. Okay. Yeah. So it's interesting that we're talking about competence and incompetence, and because that's definitely a factor. And I think part of the factor I see is, and Jesse's raised this point a number of times in previous salons, which is, we don't have an elite that's unified behind any kind of social contract or social construct. It's that the entrenched elites are warring with themselves. And by just focusing on how much more they can get, their own kleptocrat tendencies, they of course become incompetent because they're no longer looking at anything beyond, their own little grubby reach, right? And so, and we see this in the fall of nations, where once your elites are only focused on fighting each other for as much as they can get. And they lose all sense of proportion, and they're not willing to make any sacrifices to fix the system or deal with externalities or anything else. Then, so their incompetence is structural, is what I'm saying. It's not just a personal flaw. It's that it's kind of like the equivalent of fiddling while Rome burns. That is not historically accurate, but the whole idea is that you're so focused on your kleptocrat gains that you have lost sight of the bigger picture. I want to make two other points I want to hear you guys feedback on. One of them is GDP itself, gross domestic product. It's a measure of flow. In other words, it's all about adding up the transactions that occurred in a particular period of time. And that's considered, quote, the health of the economy and therefore of the society. Well, the sort of degrowth model is or gross happiness index, like the Nation of Bhutan uses, it's all about looking at the balance sheet of wealth and well-being. So I think it for the global economy, by focusing on the flow and measuring the flow of transactions, we've incentivized just consumption, right? Borrowing and consuming, because that increases the rate of flow. But actually that's been hollowing out our well-being, right? Our real wealth, right? We've been destroying that in this effort to keep increasing our rate of transactional flow. So, and a lot of people are glomming onto this, that it's like they're looking at our well-being collapsing while our GDP keeps going up, and it's all like, hey, maybe we're measuring the wrong things, right? So that's a point I want you guys to talk about. And I think in terms of the hollowing out of the whole system, I think one idea is, you know, there's this idea of core and periphery, you know, like the imperial center and then the periphery nations that get exploited. And so I've often said that when I talk about neo-feudalism, what we have is all that exploitation and kleptocracy that we used to just strip mine the peripheral countries of resources and so on. That model sort of expended itself, and so now we've gone and we're cannibalizing the core itself.
Although I would argue that it's not that it ran its course, but to your point, it's returned home. It's flipped over. Because the extractive industries are still devastating the planet. They're still driving that growth. They're still fueling it. But they have flipped over in that the data industries are extractive, only that they're extractive of the brain, of the cyber. And the cultural industries are extractive, especially in terms of the forefronts of the attention economy and trying to incentivize people to watch one more video. Because, you know, I think the concept that unites a lot of your comments there, Charles, is the obstacle or the hindrance that a big chunk of the elite has that I think prevents them from being even more competent is their narcissism, right? And I think the extent to which narcissism is a plague in our culture, I mean, that hurts the elite the same way that it hurts society. And because, to go back to our original metaphor of the influencer on the private jet, because so much of the elite is subsumed in their own narcissism, is subsumed in their own immediate pursuit of gratification and riches and attention, they've lost sight of the long game. Versus if you look at the kind of capitalists, and I mean this in a sinister sense, but I also mean this in the noblesse oblige sense, that the capitalists who recognize that if they funded infrastructure, that if they funded welfare, that if they kept the working class stable, that resulted in more profits, that resulted in greater control. You know, that's partly why the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, you know, understood the long game, understood the long con of their kind of capitalism. And it kept them in power for a really long time because they recognized the need to pay back. They recognized the need to create that kind of infrastructure, that kind of society that has been lost, that doesn't exist now. And I think that's why capitalism has reached such a precarious point, because you no longer have that sense of commitment. It's, you know, everyone for themselves, and it's, you know, what's in it for me, as the kind of narcissistic ideology that I think has overcome most capitalist ideology in terms of how people really perceive the world and perceive their part in it. And so I think the desire to be post-growth, I think the desire to be more sustainable is not mutually exclusive with capitalism. And I think that there are some smart capitalists who are wrapping their heads around that because they want to be around for the long term. They want to maintain their wealth and their position for the long term. You know, I think overall what we're seeing as a society is a deficit of philosophy. That we need more philosophers, we need more philosophy, we need more big ideas that help people see past the immediate event horizon. Because I think the pandemic has done a lot of things, whether it's demonstrate the lack of leadership we have in society or demonstrate the lack of philosophy, the lack of creative philosophy. You know, I I went to a Zoom comedy event this week, which was, you know, the comedy industry trying to adapt and come up with online shows. And I was really impressed. I was really left inspired, which I'll articulate it in capitalist terms, which fits, Mark, your kind of, you know, vision of how markets should operate. These folks were adapting, right? They were taking the conditions of the market. They were not letting them stop. They may not be making the same amount of money, but I hypothesized they could grow their business to a size that was not previously possible, because a comedy club has a finite capacity. And I personally would never go to a comedy club. It's just not my culture. It's not my vibe. But I'd show up to a comedy Zoom 2-3 times a week. And so that's where I think there's an opportunity for scale, an opportunity to get rid of the middleman, because this comedy show was run by the comedians, right? There was no one else running this outfit. It was far more efficient with greater potential for them. So, you know, to go to Mark's vision of a marketplace where those who don't have the right business model fail and those who adapt thrive, survive, and prosper, you know, I think that that's possible in the way in which we're seeing elements of the response to the pandemic. To bring it back to your point, Mark, it's a question of how crooked the economy ends up being. That if the government is just printing money to then give to big business as a subsidy, so if they were to, let's say, bail out all the big comedy clubs and give them exclusive Zoom licenses and make it illegal for comedians to organize their own virtual comedy clubs, right? That is the type of heinous monopoly activity that we'd all be against. Versus the reality is it's the comedians who should be subsidized. They're the ones who have a new business model, who have a new way of configuring the industry that I think has much greater potential. So it's a question of which the system or which the elements of the current economic configuration would empower.
I thought we were the online comedy show. But,
We aspire, but the difference between us and them is real time.
Right.
That when we do a Zoom with all of our audience unmuted as part of the podcast and it doesn't become incoherent, that's when we can hold ourselves to their level.
To Charles's point about GDP, I used to read Adbusters religiously, and not when I was left of center, when I was still a full-on anarcho-capitalist.
It is a right-wing magazine. And I don't say that as a bad thing. I just say that as a Cali Lazin, the guy who runs it, you know, anti-communist in the biggest sense. Like,
oh, I never knew that.
Eastern Europe, yeah.
I always thought...
So you and he, your politics are like this.
I always thought they were like seriously left of center, but I thought there's a big overlap between... So at any rate, they ran this sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, a print meme or something, numerous times. You know, every time somebody's diagnosed with cancer, every time a car drives off a cliff, every time a house blows up, every time a child dies of some horrible disease, all of these things, every time one of these terrible things happens, the GDP goes up. And when the GDP goes up, everybody high fives. And you're right, it is measuring the wrong things completely. It's like, one of you made, I guess it was Charles, you said, you know, they're not looking at the balance sheet. Because on the balance sheet, savings are great. But in this day and age, if you have too much savings, you're actually being bad. You're being unpatriotic. You're holding the economy back. And if companies have too much cash on their books, they get punished by Wall Street for not paying that out, or even better, let them borrow a bunch of money and pay that out as dividends. That's like smart financial acumen these days, which I think is absolutely delusional. And what we have to start doing is realizing that what creates a healthy economy is the stuff we don't consume. I mean, that's where we, you know, stored capital formation that you can then take and invest into something else. That's where a healthy economy comes from, not just, you know, forcing consumption. But I mean, because we use debt for money, that has to expand all the time. And it's like a heroin fix over and over and over again. If somebody stops spending money and somebody stops borrowing money, it just goes, the whole system goes into withdrawal. There was two things I wanted to mention. I guess going back to the magic thing, the magical thinking thing, I was going to bring up, Charles, you've been on Jim Kunstler's show a few times, and he's got that book, Too Much Magic, where he sort of goes through each segment of the society and how this magical thinking. Now, he wrote that. Was that before the financial crisis or was it after? I can't even remember when that book came out. And then the other one was John Michael Greer, I think, his whole concept of catabolic collapse, how the system will eat itself out from the inside out as it's starting to collapse in on itself. And bringing the whole thing back to the capital K of kleptocracy, you know, I've heard the whole K-shaped recovery thing over and over again this year, but I never really stopped to think about what that meant until just this week, actually. And I'm like, this is, well, I've called the same phenomena, my word for it was the great bifurcation, right? This is the breakaway society now. This is where, and it kind of really pains me to watch this happen, this is where the winners and the losers of this huge tectonic shift are getting sorted out this year. And I, like, this is a process that I thought was going to take the next 5 decades. And there was going to be plenty of time to try and wake people up and say, look, society is going this way. All the incentives are going this way. You have to re-gear yourself to be positioned this on this side of this line, or you're going to be almost a second-class citizen with no rights or standing. And all of that happened within 1 year this year. And that, I guess that's why sometimes I get almost out of, like, almost in a hysterical out of sortness about this when I'll see just a particular piece of media, which I should learn to ignore more, or I just see it. It just pulled forward a lot of inequality acceleration into 1 year that it just seems to be overwhelming at times, a lot of times.
Well, and I think that's where, you know, when people wonder what's the future of the economy, I think to your point, 2008 gave us a foreshadowing.
Yeah.
In that it was a bifurcated recovery.
Yeah.
That there were some people who had a fantastic recovery of 2008, and there were many more who never recovered from 2008. And the same thing's going to apply here. There will be some people who recover, but there will be many more who never recover. And, you know, I know I criticize you or kind of mock you for the way in which you unite the media into a single voice, but I think where you're right is that there will be a kind of concerted narrative, or at least an echoing narrative, in which I think the people who don't recover are not going to be included. That they'll get lip service, like homeless or poor or, you know, other categories, but the actual plight, the actual reaction, I think is lost. And ironically, I mean, that's where TikTok in its randomness is an interesting media, because just the other day I saw a few, you know, instances of people showing their neighbors being evicted. Hmm. And, you know, it's those little warning signs. It's those little bits that sort of let you know that, in fact, there's quite a bit of suffering. There's quite a bit of severe impact from this crisis that, you know, these are people who are not necessarily going to have the chance to recover insofar as the way in which that narrative of the, you know, the V curve, the K curve, you know, however it's articulated, it's a bifurcation, right? It's not a single curve. There'll be some people who will be recovering. There'll be many more who weren't. And how we manage that, I think, is the real challenge moving forward.
I've been thinking about, you know, I called it the great bifurcation for years now. Whenever I sort of sit down to think about that, because it's actually, on my planned list of books to write, that's one of the installments in it. And when I think about it and make my notes and write out my thoughts, I think there's no avoiding it. And that makes me extremely sad. And I think the only way to even make a pretense of justness in a world like that is that that ceiling and floor that separates the haves from the have-nots has to be completely permeable. And I don't think it's going to be. I think it's going to be if you're on the wrong side of this line when all of this sort of ossifies into the structure of life, there is no ever getting onto the other side of it. I know I tend to project a little too far out into the future too fast and look at extreme examples, but I guess it's just I'm just saying that there's going to be this new, I guess what Charles calls the neo-feudalism, this sort of nouveau poverty. I mean, there'll be things like UBI, Universal Basic Income. It'll be a digital cash. You're not going to be able to save it because it'll expire if you don't spend it. They'll deposit, you know, digital coin into your bank account every month, and whatever you don't spend by the end of the month just vaporizes. Because they have to keep money velocity up. And if you take it and say, well, I want to put it in the bank and save it, they're just going to laugh at you, you know, or it'll be negative interest rates in the bank. They'll say, yeah, sure. It's only going to cost you like 0.1% a month. And once it takes hold, I mean, it's going to be pretty hard to ratchet back from that. Jesse is back. Okay. Yeah. I don't know how much of that you got. So we might have to swing it to Charles now.
Yeah, take it over, Charles.
I don't know how to get rid of the zombie Jesse either.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm going to try to tie back something that Jesse brought up, which I think is a underappreciated topic, not just on our salons, but just globally, which is the decline of faith, if you will. And, you know, of religion, of organized religion, let's put it that way. And this has been documented, right? And so it's not surprising, right, that when times are good, then people don't need the security offered by a religion, right? So therefore you switch your allegiance to secular gods like the Federal Reserve or something. And then when things go sour and things become insecure, then people as a generality find a need for some sort of faith that helps them get through these hard times, right? The insecurity they face, right? And that, because that's part of what religion is, as well as, and at least in the traditional sense, you're sharing, you know, things, perhaps even material goods, right? I mean, that's a part of many faiths. So I want to tie that into this winner take all or winner take most and winners and losers kind of thing, because the elites, whether implicitly or not, sort of mock religion as you know, more or less like owning a lot of, you know, guns or something. Like it's some sort of primitive attempt to gain security. And it's easy to mock from if you're at the top, right, looking down. But I think that as things unravel, it may be that we need, to Jesse's point about new philosophies, we may need like new models of doing things, but we also may need a return to some sort of shared, how do you want to call it, moral foundation, because that's part of what kleptocracy has eroded, right? It's more or less winner take all and everybody for themselves, right? And so you can't have any social cohesion if you've devolved to that state of society. And social cohesion is really the core of a power, if you will. In other words, like if you're going to make the sacrifices to get through some kind of crisis, if it's not shared sacrifice, then it's gonna just come apart, right? And we're talking about this hollowing out, this cannibalizing, and bifurcation. So I think where does that go? I think if you cannot find some sort of unifying set of values or moral foundations, then you've got nothing. You're gonna go down to collapse, the catabolic collapse, which of course is kind of stair-stepping as you devolve to a state and get, you know, stabilized there, then you go down to it's almost thermodynamic, right? And I think we can look at that too.
Well, you talking about religion, I think that you're right. I mean, it's on the decline. I always have to specify a distinction that there's a difference between religion and spirituality, I think. I mean, we have an old joke in a recovery group that I frequent that religion is for people who want to stay out of hell and spirituality is for people who've been there. So there's this natural inclination for some people to sort of poo-poo structured religion as like, oh, that's just a bunch of wingnuts who believe in a cosmic flying spaghetti monster, and they almost kind of dismiss it as that, and that, so it has no role in a modern society today. But I think that to that point, I even saw some mainstream press articles talking about how religious people are making the pandemic worse because they don't care if they die because they think they'll go to heaven. And I don't know a single religious person who's like, oh, I don't care if I die from COVID because I'll just go to heaven. Like, I think that's some crazy logic. But in our worship of our own cleverness, and we think that we've got everything figured out, we can just whiteboard the economy and plan it all out. We can whiteboard our pandemic response and plan it all out. We've got these wonderful, we've got AI and we've got machine learning, and we can just map out society perfectly. This whole idea is becoming the religion unto itself, because I think there's this recognition subconsciously that you need that sort of bigger picture element of the psyche, of the collective psyche, and if atheism is kind of winning the day, you've got to fill it in with something. And so you see mainstream articles like in the Wall Street Journal, they said, well, the coronavirus response may have us, we may have to finally conquer death, and we're going to upload our minds into the cloud. And this wasn't like, you would expect to see this in like Nexus magazine, but this was Wall Street Journal. And so this is becoming our new religion. And this one is the subject of my next book. So sorry to talk up my forthcoming book about these dangers of techno-utopian thinking, but it's the decline of, like, I suppose, it almost tradition, and we're trying to replace it with something that fulfills the same psychological or spiritual need, but it's completely, like, in the here and now. It's algorithmically driven, and it's just this super magical belief. It's magical thinking again of what we can accomplish with AI, which doesn't even really exist.
So there's a lot of sweeping generalizations there, which, you know, are hard to either acknowledge or dissect. But I'll start by agreeing with the last one. I certainly share your critique of the transhumanist singularity cult and the extent to which that taking that point that it is a religion, I think that disproves your earlier points that religion is on the decline and that atheism has won, because both of that's nonsense, right?
Well, like structured.
Religion, hold on. Religion has never been on the decline. It's just in organized form has not always been easy to identify. For example, I've argued for years that consumerism is a polytheistic religion that's based on the idea that you can worship all sorts of gods in the consumer universe based on using the currency of the almighty dollar. So I don't think we've ever escaped religion. I just think our literacy of religion, the role that religion has played in our lives, has shifted, has changed, transformed. And to your point, technology is now giving birth to a new god called AI, which is a false god because it doesn't exist. But like all religions, it enriches the priestly class. It enriches the people who own the church. And that's always the question you gotta ask is, you know, who is the beneficiary? What are the larger ownership or wealth considerations that come with this belief? And, you know, I think that that's something that we can and should talk about in a future episode, not just because it's a future book of yours, because I think it ties into a lot of the conversations we have around network states and influencers and leadership and so forth. So it's totally relevant. But I do feel that we're getting off track, especially when we're trying to end today's conversation.
It was pretty late in the episode to veer into religion, I know. Yeah. That was Charles's fault.
No, I don't blame Charles. I think you took that rope and hung yourself with it, even if Charles gave you the rope.
Well, but I was trying Charles to think of something point, to say.
Charles's point, which, you know, I think is a recurring theme we've talked about, I will rearticulate in the word social contract. That what we currently don't have in our society is a social contract, something where we all agree that these are the rules that we, in living together and having social relations, adhere to. And I think the biggest absence on that social contract is the notion of theft, because that's where the kleptocracy is an issue. What I thought was fascinating about that Hidden Forces episode is the way it argued that theft, that kleptocracy as a culture, is far more normalized throughout the world and is now becoming normalized in North America, but has always kind of been the norm. So that's an example of an absence of a social contract, that we sort of wish there'd be a social contract of that. But as a pirate, I'm also conscious of the idea that one man's theft is not another man's theft. And that in the digital world, because copying is a feature and not a bug, maybe our notion of theft has to be completely changed, in that it's no longer theft that is the definition of kleptocracy. It's the naked pursuit of the self-interest at the expense of the collective interest. Right? We don't mind pursuit of the self-interest when it helps, or at least doesn't hinder, the collective interest. But when the pursuit of the self-interest is at the expense of the collective interest, I think that's where maybe we should be drawing the line. And I think the capitalist argument to their fellow capitalists is that when you undermine the collective interest, you undermine capitalism. You ruin the game for everybody else. So at a certain point, you got to respect the rules of the road and make sure that there'll always be room for us in the future. And that brings in the climate change and the climate concern.
Well, I was going to say the devil in those details is how do you rationally define what collective interests are? Because
some would say that's a tough negotiation.
Yeah, some people would say there's no such thing as collective interest. There is only an aggregate of individual interests that create trends or movements or tectonic shifts.
And the devil's advocate to that jerk would be, well, there's no such thing as an individual. And we only exist within collectives. And you may call yourself an individual, but you're actually a federation of billions of bacteria that comprise your consciousness and your immune system and everything that makes you possible. Neither of those positions, I think, are valid. But I agree with you 100% that the negotiation of what those collective interests are is the question at hand. That is the difficult problem for a society to address. And I think the more it puts that off, the more that narcissism will continue to reign in a self-destructive, unsustainable manner that it currently does.
Yeah, well, I'll do my wrap-up comments here, which is, I think we're really getting down to the core issue going forward, the social construct, you know, I say social construct, but it's the social contract and the common good. And I just would say 2 points that we should elaborate further in another salon is, you cannot have a social contract without social cohesion. In other words, there has to be some foundational agreement, you know, of values that are underlying the system or the processes, right? So it's not just a transactional thing where we're debating in a legislature or something. You've got to have some moral foundation to the social cohesion. And to Jesse's point about sacrificing for the common good, this was what Jesse referred to as the previous class of uber capitalists understood this, and it was pretty obvious. I mean, Rockefeller and Carnegie knew exactly what the common good was, and it was obvious to everybody. You know, infrastructure, so you can move around and you can move goods and services, education, because the, you know, production of the society is better with more education, and health. I mean, so these are just really common things, and the fact that we've lost sight of what the common good is a sign of just how far down the the path of collapse we are. But social cohesion and where that could come from, I think that's a great topic for future Salon.
With the obvious being freedom, because that's something that you don't have unless you have people to protect you, right? Like an individual can't have freedom insofar as there's another individual who has more force who's willing to take their freedom. So the way in which you achieve freedom is you find other people who want freedom, and together you negotiate a social contract with the focus on that freedom. But what are the costs to achieve that freedom? Collective security being one of the biggest, but of course there's other issues that arise from that.
And the libertarians would say that is the sole function of the state. The sole legitimate function of the state is to have that monopoly on violence and use it to guarantee everybody's rights and the enforcement of law and no
See,
other
I
rights.
I would argue, why do we need to give the state the monopoly on violence?
Now you're an anarcho-capitalist.
Monopoly. No, because I don't believe in the capitalism.
Well, now you're an anarcho-something.
Being an anarcho. Yeah, exactly.
So okay, sorry. Yes. Now you've gone full anarchist there. So
I was should entertaining
just,
it.
We should
I
just end it there,
I was
Jesse.
Suggesting.
Jesse
but
has
yeah,
gone
I'll
anarchist.
Be rounded up or shot as a result of that admission. So this is a good time to end.
Okay, so that was Axis
of Truck on the Road.
Axis of Easy 28. Don't forget to like us on YouTube, Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes. Leave us a review on iTunes. Those really help. And let's just throw in a collective from the three of us appeal for calm and reason and sanity in your election next week. Good luck. And, you know, let's just everyone take a deep breath and calm down.